Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On today's show, UK comedian Carl Donnelly returns to the show to talk about his brand new stand-up comedy show appearing at the Melbourne and Sydney Comedy Festival. My name is Justin Hamilton and I'm about to glow up. Yes, that is the title of Carl's show here on Big Squid. Always a treat to have your company and always a treat to have Carl Donnelly on the show. Carl is a good mate of mine and he is out here in Australia at the moment and will be appearing at the Melbourne and Sydney Comedy Festivals with his show Glow Up. I'm going to try and have a few comedians on in the lead up to the festivals, and I have to say, thanks to everyone who has emailed me or reached out and told me about going and seeing Rob Carlton at the Adelaide Fringe. Unanimous praise for his show. 5-star reviews over there. And 5-star reviews, well, I've got to be honest, no one was giving stars to me, but they were effusive in their praise, and therefore they read like 5-star reviews. Oh, no, anyone who reads my blog knows that it might might read like a 5-star review, but it's a 4-star review. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is thanks to everyone who reached out to me and told me that they went and checked out his show and how much they loved it. It's great to know that you went and saw it, and I appreciate that this podcast helped nudge you in that direction to go and find him. Coming up soon is Cameron James, who'll be in Adelaide. So I've worked with Cam on his new show, Mixtape. It's fantastic. It's going to be at the Rhino Room, my home away from home. So that will be the next one to check out in the Adelaide Fringe, Melbourne Comedy Festival and Sydney Comedy Festival. But yes, I'll try and have a few more comedians on who are doing shows, and I'll try and have a few people that you maybe haven't heard of before. One person in particular, I'm going to try and have some time with her in the next 4 or 5 days so I can get that podcast up for you next week. But yes. Anyway, I won't tell you who it is. I'll see if I can get some time in with her. And yeah, I think she's a really interesting comedian, and I think it'll be nice for those of you who don't know her to discover her. Okay, enough preamble about what may or may not be coming up in the future. I'm off to see Dune 2, the premiere of that, so I'm sure I'll share some thoughts with you about that movie soon as well. But in the meantime, let's welcome to the stage, to the microphone, to the podcast, the adorable Carl Donnelly.
Hello. as a man who lives by himself and spends a lot of time by himself as well, it's been an absolute joy to have you staying with me and have someone to come home to.
Cheers, mate. Yeah.
I'd like to thank your wife and my friend, Hannah Norris, for letting you stay with me and give me some company.
Yeah. That's what you need, people. You need to sort of ship them in once a week.
Yeah.
Just ship in a friend for 2 days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of perfect a little bit. Do you have a lot of people, when you're back home in the UK, are people wanting to stay with you all the time? Because I've stayed with you guys.
You stayed with us, but not really. It tends to be... Well, actually now, in particular, we moved from the place you stayed when we were there. We've moved. And our new place, because now we've got a child.
Yes.
When we used to have two bedrooms, you know, we had a spare bedroom. Now we've got two bedrooms and one of them is lived in by a 3.5-year-old.
Yeah, right.
So we don't have the... I think when you've got a kid, people ask to stay less.
Yes.
Because space, but also a mixture of, we don't want to impose when there's a toddler around.
Yes.
And also, they probably don't want to get woken up at 6:30 a.m. by my daughter wanting to show them how she can hop.
I feel like that would be a delightful way to wake up. I'd be like totally into that. But that's a very interesting thing. I reckon there have definitely been friends like our mate Limo.
Yeah.
I would stay with him when I was in Melbourne. And when his son was young, I didn't.
Yeah.
But now that he's a little bit
it's
older.
It's almost like an unwritten rule, isn't it? I've never heard it discussed, but...
No.
I definitely, if I had friends with a child, would probably be like, I'm okay. Like, I'll find somewhere else.
Yeah. Even though I like to think that I'm a pretty good guest. Like, I kind of keep to myself, you know, tidy up after myself.
Yeah.
But when it's a baby, you don't want to be absolutely misconstrued as an imposition in any way.
No. Yeah, I've never thought about it.
Yeah. But once they get older, I'm like, well, once I can have a conversation with the kid,
then
I feel like we're on level footing. If anything, I can be hanging out with the kid and my friends can have a breather.
Because it is fine. We had a friend stay last summer, just before the Edinburgh Fringe.
Mm.
Our friend Rebecca came and stayed with us.
Oh, yeah.
And we've got, in our living room, we have got a sofa bed. So we have got room for people.
Yeah.
And she stayed for like, I reckon it was a week.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely fine. It was quite like, it was having Twyla was probably just turned 3.
Yeah.
And she liked it because they get on and it was nice. It was quite a nice little dynamic. So it wasn't a problem. But I do think people would self-police and be like, I just won't ask to stay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely a thing. Also, you guys are social with Twyla as well. So she's a social kid.
Yeah. I mean, but it's like... From day one, I think, she's always just come out with us to everything. Not in the evening. We're not, like, taking her to the pub at 10 p.m.
Yep.
But, you know, we both love a pub beer garden and, you know, or a picnic or something when you're having a few drinks and, like, with like, loads of other people. And it's... Because I grew up with that. I grew up in pubs.
Right.
Yeah, you know, Irish parents. Yep. I spent a lot of time in pubs when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then we actually lived in a pub from when I was 9. So I've got none of that... Some people don't like kids in pubs.
Yeah.
From their perspective of being in a pub, they don't want kids running around.
Oh, right.
Some people feel a bit weird bringing their kids to a pub.
I don't
know. Well, maybe it's the alcohol thing.
Yeah.
But I've always seen pubs as family places.
Yeah. How long did your family own a pub?
Well, they didn't own it, so my uncle owned it.
Right.
Before he got done for fraud.
Right.
And lost everything.
Yeah. Big shout out if he's listening.
Yeah. He passed away a few years ago.
Oh, okay.
I actually did get on with him towards the end. Me and him used to have a very fractured relationship.
Right.
But...
That's a weird thing to be, like, a young fella and, you know, you brought up to respect your peers and... not your peers, but your family.
Yeah.
And then you find out, like, fraud...
Not even found out. I remember it all happening at the time. Like,
right.
We moved into the pub. He basically asked my parents if they'd manage it for him.
Right.
Ended up being the worst thing that ever happened to my family.
Right.
Like, in terms of, my dad liked a drink.
Yeah.
He could not be trusted with living in a pub. Was like the most terrible decision.
Yeah.
Like, and my mum's... sort of was always it just basically almost ruined my family. Like, my parents split up for a bit after, like, towards the end, after 2 years in the pub.
Right.
They split up and separated for a year, because it just sent them both mad. My dad was just boozing, and then my dad started nicking booze, and like, you know, he wasn't paying for any of the booze, but he was taking a bit too much.
Right.
And then, like, when he was drunk, he'd just go and open the cigarette machine and take a pack out and just smoke. Like, and it basically ended up being like there was loads of money just missing off the books because he was just drinking and smoking it.
Wow.
And then they just fell apart and broke up. But like, but then they sorted themselves out again. And after, it was almost like that. It's like the Amityville, you know? The house was the problem, not their family. So when we moved out.
Like literally the spirits.
So once they, about a year, little period apart after, my dad sort of sorted himself out, stopped drinking as much. And he said he wasn't like an alcoholic. He was an alcoholic when we were there.
Yes.
But in real life, he wasn't. It was almost like this place.
Yes.
Once back home, like, he could still go out once a week and have a drink and wouldn't touch another drop the whole week. Like, it was weird. It was like, it sent the whole family mad.
I feel like I'm that way with lollies.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? The reason I bring this up is because I'm working on Dancing with the Stars at the moment, and there's snacks everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I never have lollies in the house. I would never even think to buy lollies.
Yeah.
But as soon as I see a pack of, you know, Jube lollies in a corner, it's like, it's like I can't stop.
Yes. Yeah, I'm similar. Like, we're staying at Hannah's parents in Melbourne at the minute, while we're in the country.
Yeah.
And they love a snack.
Right.
Her dad's got his little biscuit collection up on a shelf.
Yeah.
And mum's always got loads of sweets and ice cream. And
yeah.
It is hard. It's hard. It's just all there.
Yes.
I do think there is a, you know, I'm somebody who, I've got a sweet tooth.
Yeah.
But I'll tend to treat myself when I'm out and about. I don't buy a lot of it for the house.
Yeah.
Because when I'm in the house and it's just around me.
I'm cursed with having a sweet tooth and a savoury tooth. Like, I'll have both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I can't have lollies or chips. Like, it's a disaster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, hang on. So, yeah. So, you know, your uncle gets done for fraud.
Yeah.
And, like, don't get me wrong. I know fraud is not a good thing. Like, so I'm not going to compare it to other things.
He didn't go to prison or anything. I will say it wasn't. It was basically he ended up getting into a court case with the brewery that owned or that supplied the pubs he owned.
Yeah.
And it turned out he was sort of scamming them. And then he tried to countersue.
Right.
And they were like, and they basically, they then came back and just wiped him out. They took everything.
Right.
Because of what he'd done financially behind the closed doors.
Yeah.
So he ended up in prison or anything. I think he had been in prison previously, but that's a different story.
Well, not for fraud.
No. I think it was more for other crimes.
Yeah. But fraud is like one of those things where, I don't know, maybe I'm just being a little bit naive, but fraud to me is like, you know, they murdered someone or they did this or they did that. And fraud, you're like, oh, come on, mate.
Do you know
what I mean? Like, it feels...
I think it's also quite a broad church, the fraud world. You know what I mean? There's such different... You know, there's technically, you know, it's fraud to sort of not declare something on your tax return. You know, there's sort of such low-level fraud.
There's
corporate fraud.
Yeah.
And then I think fraud is a real catch-all for loads of different crimes.
Yeah, and then acting like a fraud.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I think his was more just he was a bit dodgy with the accounting.
Right.
And then tried to somehow blame the brewery for some stuff.
Right.
And they then did like a forensic accounting job on his books and were like, no, you owe us everything you own.
What's the, before I say this next thing, what's the cutoff point with back taxes? Is it 5 years? Like, if you go back,
I don't know, actually.
Is it 7 years?
I don't know what it's like here. I know in the UK.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I won't name this person.
Yeah.
But
Stuart Lee.
No, but I know there was somebody who went on a TV show.
Yeah.
This was like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
They got asked to do a stand-up set on a TV show.
Yeah.
And they had been doing comedy for like 10 years at that point.
Right.
And they had never even registered as self-employed. They'd not declared a single bit of income as a stand-up comedian.
Right.
And then they went on television.
Yeah.
And I think just obviously once they were on telly, somehow HMRC just basically looked them up on the system and they weren't listed. And then they sort of got in touch and were like, we just want to check, like, have you paid any tax on your stand-up income? And he was like, no. And they then got him to send, you know, they basically did some Googling, could see that he'd been around gigging for quite a while, and they went and they like almost guessed, right, this is what we think you've earned in the last decade. And I think he got hit with £100,000 tax bill.
Oh,
I mean, he's never paid. He's not. It's going to take him forever to pay off.
Yes.
Like, it's not somebody who then the TV elevated to being like a massive comic. It was like a one-off thing.
Oh, no.
You know. Oh, God.
Well, it also probably sounds like they've overestimated how much he earned as well, right?
I think they probably could have. Yeah. But, I mean, that's by the by. And also, I'm not... It's absolutely his fault. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's, you know, yes. I'm not somebody... I'm not saying, you know... I declare everything. My accountant always said to me, just declare all your income,
yep,
and you'll never get like investigated. There won't be any issue.
Right.
He said you can basically, and he always said to me, like, you could put through everything you buy on expenses,
yep,
and it would get through if you're declaring all your income. Not that I'm saying you should do that. I don't, like, but he said if you wanted to, like, if you're self-employed,
yeah,
because you can literally just, like, the tax man doesn't really ever check that you might be being a bit dodgy with your expenses. They only check if they think you're not declaring income.
Yes.
And so I've always had that in my mind from day one. I was like, just declare everything. Don't do that thing of getting a bit of a cash gig and being like,
hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. I'm pretty similar, actually. I do quarterly tax. So it's every 3 months I'm doing tax, which a lot of my friends are like, it does their heads in. But I'd rather stay on top of it.
Yep.
And I'd rather look into my account and go, that's mine.
Yes.
Than I think that's mine.
Like, yeah.
You know, like, on the one hand, I don't have a mortgage or anything like that. But on the other hand, I don't have any debt.
Yes.
And that there's a freedom to that.
Yeah, of course.
isn't it one of the great moments in early in your career when you realize that if you take something on stage, you can declare it?
Yes.
Or talk about it.
Yeah. And also, to be fair, like, you know, a lot of your general day-to-day costs are actually part of your job. You know, it's sort of, it's not dodgy.
No.
If you're self-employed and you spend a lot of time, if you're sat in cafes writing all day.
Yeah.
That is work.
Yeah.
You know, so you're sure you are allowed to claim those coffees and, you know, it'd be weird if you didn't. You know, I mean, you're actually... You know, your transport to any work-related thing.
Yeah.
You know, and my accountant was always like, anytime you go to anything cultural, and then tickets to a theatre show, a cinema, gig, like, he goes, you're allowed to put that through because, you know, especially because my stand-up is always stories related to what I've done in my life. You know, so he goes, like, that is technically research if you end up talking about it in particular.
Yeah.
But, you know, you might not end up talking about it, but you can still call it what it is, which is sort of research.
Yeah. Well, because you've got a new show at the moment, and like one of the things, I don't know if I just did this. I actually have done this for so long. I don't know if it's something that I learned from hearing someone speak or if it's something that I just kind of did naturally. I think I may have just done it naturally. But I'll see something in a different art form and then try to apply, speaking from a structure point of view, I'll then try and apply it to what I'm doing on stage. So as an example, the first solo show that I ever performed back in 2000, I based the beats of it on Woody Allen's Manhattan.
Right.
So the show was nothing like Manhattan.
Yeah.
But I just kind of instinctively knew, oh, that's end of act one, that's the end of act two, and this will get me to my conclusion.
I
learned from that.
Okay, yeah, that's cool. I've never had that in terms of structure in a show.
Right.
I don't really know. I don't really have a process when it comes to like that, thinking about the structure of a show. As much of, I just, you know, because my shows, I always want it to sound like a conversation.
Mm.
You know, I purposely, from day one, my stand-up's always been like, I want it to look like I've just wandered on stage.
Yeah.
And have a little chat to them. And then I'm just like, see you later.
Yeah.
Like, it's all very conscious. I'm doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, it often is the case, like, you know, I think it's... I've not read a review of myself in a decade or something, but I remember I used to read them when I was new, and I used to really enjoy getting quite a bad review that basically sort of hinted that, oh, it looks like he's just wandered on and tells us a few stories and then wanders off. And I was like, that's exactly what I've done.
Yes.
You know, they think I haven't put any work into it.
Yes.
And I was like, that means I've done it really well when they think, oh, he's not trying.
Yes.
You know, even if they, some reviewers often, you know, they'll mention how well you did in the gig. They might say that the crowd were loving it and all that, but then they obviously put their own opinion into it, which is what a review is. That's, you know, yes. You can't. So
By the way, that's a good review. Like, if they can, that's a good reviewer. If they can point out that how the audience was experiencing it and then their opinion, there's nothing worse than someone saying something's terrible and not funny when the audience was having a good time. And it's you didn't find it funny, but the people there loved it.
Yeah. I remember getting a couple of reviews where, like, it was almost like I did it well enough that they didn't think I was trying.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm going for. I want it to genuinely look like just your mates just walked on and just had a chat with you.
Yeah.
And so when I'm writing a show, I tend not to think as much about structure in terms of it being like a piece of work.
Right.
And I structure it more to be like, how can this sound like I've just started rambling?
Right.
And then suddenly an hour's up and you're like, bloody hell. So, like, often, like, so this show at the minute, there's one big story, and I'm still sort of working it out whether or not the story's going to be the full backbone of the show.
Right.
Or if it's just going to, the story starts about halfway through, you know, and the pre, it's all like, here's, you know, here's where I'm at, here's some thoughts, a few funny little bits and observations, having a chat, and then I go into this story, and the story just is the rest of the show, and there's loads coming off it.
Yeah.
So I keep coming out of the story and then going back into it.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it's like, oh, there we go. That's the end of it. And
yeah.
So my structures are always, how can I make this look like I'm not doing a show?
So do you, I'm guessing your shows invariably, you have a routine that you're enjoying, and then you explore it. Is that right? Or do you go into it with goals in particular, or do you kind of find the goals
I've done different types of it. Last year I did a show about my dad dying,
yes,
and that obviously was the starting point, was my dad is dead,
yeah,
so I'm going to write a show about this.
Yeah,
so I started from not scratch, but you know, I had what I was going to talk about,
yeah,
so everything had to fit in with it, and everything was on the point of this is what it's about. And so I've done it a couple of times where something has happened in my life that I'm like, the show has to be about this.
Yeah.
But then normally, the other years, it does come out of, I normally get to like imagine, so if I'm doing a show here, and then the show is sort of starting in Melbourne, basically.
Mm.
And that means normally around, I'd say probably November, late November, I almost just look at all the stuff I've written in the last month. Or 2 months, or 3 months, and I'm looking at what I've started talking about on stage, and all the little new routines that are just coming up.
Mm.
And I almost nine times out of ten, I'll see a pattern, and I'll see that's what I'm thinking about at the minute. Right. That is the topic that is mostly on my mind.
Yeah,
that is I'm talking about on stage, and that tends to be like, so the show is probably just going to be about that.
Yeah,
but then I don't sort of force the issue. I just carry on just writing for a couple of months, just whatever comes into my brain that. So naturally, I'm just writing about what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
And again, it always tends to be on a similar vein or in a similar vein. So like, and then, yeah, around January, I normally go, oh, right, this is clearly, a show is just forming.
Right.
Off these ideas. And then, yeah, and then often it will be like, which of these routines or stories is the one that is really landing?
Yeah.
You know, you can see people just like totally invested in it.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, that's going to be the big thing, whether or not it's the starting point of the show or the what the show, I tell them, like, it's almost like telling them this is what the show's about, or this is what inspired the show.
Right.
You know, and so it's quite nice. I quite like some sort of doing that thing of when it's just a stand-up show and it's an hour about a topic, but not really.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a vague thing about, like, you know, so this show is a lot about getting into my 40s and just having a little stock take of health and...
Yeah.
You know, my mental state and all that,
yeah,
and it's, you know, that's it's about as well trodden a, you know, basically it's a show about aging, which has been talked about by so many comedians, but you know, you're obviously doing it very personally,
yeah,
but what I do like doing is having a little starting like point of one, telling them like one thing started me thinking about this,
yeah,
you know, that,
yeah,
so like in this show I talk very really early on, like in one preview I did it as the opening, I said hello, basically,
yeah,
and said like thanks for coming, and then I just went, look, this show is, you know, it's sort of on a topic, and I told them that, like, the what started me writing this show was I was having coffee with a friend, and he's a 43-year-old single friend.
Mm.
And I saw on his phone that the phone wallpaper was a picture of himself. and I basically just tell him like, and it just made me suddenly think, you know, that's a bad sign, isn't it? That in your 40s, there's a picture of yourself on your phone.
Yeah.
And then it just, so that's almost like the first observation is like, I saw somebody else do something that made me think, you know, in your middle age, you've got to be wary of a few, like, just keep an eye on yourself, because otherwise you might go down a dangerous path. And then all the routines then come after that and the stories.
Right.
But it's just a nice little, like, image of sitting there with my mate being 43 and having a picture of himself on his phone. It's like, the thing that sparked the whole journey.
That is, I, you know, I don't quite understand why that feels off.
Yeah, exactly.
But it feels off.
I remember, I didn't say it to him either.
No.
Let him find out when he comes to see the show. Absolutely. He will know it's about him. And I think I did it. And a friend of mine, who was a mutual friend of ours, she saw me do a run through of it in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And she said, is that about? And she said his name. And I was like, 100% it is. She knew just from, like, she'd never seen it either, like the actual picture. But the moment I said it, she just knew it was him.
Does he have, like, super good self-esteem? Or is it, what is it? Is it an affirmation? It's like, no, I'm still here.
I don't know.
Is it a goal?
He's a very confident.
Yeah.
Like, he's very confident, like, handsome, like, you know, 43-year-old bachelor.
Yeah.
And he's definitely got some issues about he's got more issues about his place in, he's a comedian, but his place in comedy, he's got loads of insecurities.
Oh, yeah.
And his career. But actually, as a person, he's very confident and very charming, very funny.
Right.
But, like, an eternal bachelor.
Yeah.
And not just a single guy in his 40s. I mean, like, he's just such a commitment phobe and all that. So there's loads of little things that I think, if you actually zoomed in, you'd be like, these are some issues you should probably work on before you get to 50. Because, you know, these could become bigger problems.
Mate, you know, I have been saying to people, the older you get, the more you become. Mm. So you better make sure you like you.
And
if there's something that you don't like or something that you think needs improvement, get to it, because it's just going to be accentuated as you get older. Yeah. I look at my mum, who is, she's still, you know, she's 70. She's whip smart, you know, she's pretty sharp. But her, she's always been quite rebellious. I think there was, you know, she had me when she was 19. So there's still this a little bit, you know, fuck everybody kind of attitude. And then it just comes out sometimes in ways that, you know, I think she's at a point where, you know, I think she's really offended by the fact that she gets labelled as a boomer.
Right.
When she doesn't really, apart from the age, she doesn't fit that at all.
Yeah.
So sometimes we'll just be sitting there and she will just say the most outrageous things and it's almost like she's just being rebellious to get, it's like pressing a button to see what I'll do. And I have to take it, like, I'll just kind of accept it for what it is and laugh and then just not engage.
Yeah.
But it's it's like a teenager thing.
I do, that happens with quite a few older people.
Yeah.
I think, like, you know, my father-in-law, you've met my father-in-law.
Yeah.
He loves a sort of a comment that you can hear it and you're like, I think you're fishing for a response there.
Yes.
You know, and actually, I don't even know if you think you believe that or, it's almost just pure contrarianism, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that happens with a lot of older people. Not older people. I know enough middle-aged contrarians.
Yeah.
I do think the older you get, the more you just sort of often just say things for your own entertainment.
Yeah. And I watch that and I think I've got a part of that in me.
Yeah.
And I've got to make sure that I keep a tight rein on it because at some point, I could just be, in the future, contrary for the sake of entertaining myself or just being, you know, I think there's so much noise to the world where you fundamentally agree with all this change and progress. But the thing you have to be really careful of is people telling you the thing that you've always believed before they were even born, you're thinking about it, like they're explaining it to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's a desire to push back on that.
Yeah, but I think that's just, yeah, I mean, and this is, again, this might sound patronising, but I think a lot of young people who, you know, once you get to sort of 16 to 20 or something, and you start, you start sort of forming your politics and your beliefs, you know, I think every generation does that thing where they think they invented those beliefs. And they, it's almost, you know, they can't imagine the fact that you might, you know, a 50-year-old was exactly the same and had those thoughts, and has, still has those thoughts and those beliefs. Like, because when you're young, you want to be so different to the generation before, the generations before.
Yeah.
So I do think that's why they just, they think, well, we must have been the ones to come up with these.
Yeah.
And actually, most of them are just recycled ideas of thousands of years old.
Updated. You know, I had a comedian who's, I think he's late 30s, possibly bang on 40 at the most. And we were gigging together, and after my set, and I'd, you know, I'd had a corker of a set actually, and then he was like, you know, you're just so nice on stage. And I sit there and I'm like, when's he going to get dark? And it's like, mate, I said some heinous shit in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I actually can remember, sorry, this is really poor taste, but I'm going to tell you to make a point out of it. Mm. Back in the 90s, when comedy was, at that point, was a little bit more confrontational, and gigs were much rougher.
Yeah,
like, definitely. Much rougher. So you kind of, part of being confrontational on stage and saying shocking things was survival.
Yeah.
You know, it was very difficult to not have that in your repertoire.
Mm.
And Damien, who I used to perform with, one night, we, because we used to sing songs, we dedicated a song to Christopher Reeve, and we sang Elton John's "I'm Still Standing," and it was right.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, it killed.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and
we
did that joke song 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
And then we were backstage, and I looked at Damien and I said, "Hey, I've got to be honest with you. That's making me really sad that we're doing this, because I love Christopher Reeve." And Damien looked at me and was like, "Yeah, I feel exactly the same way." I said, I think we should stop doing it. And he said, "Yeah, I think we should stop doing it as well." And I look back on that as a point of maturity.
Yes.
And so when this guy was, you know, dropping suicide jokes and things like that, I don't judge it.
No.
But I left that shit behind decades ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's, I think, you know, I mean, my stuff's never been particularly dark or anything, it's all, but I definitely, when I was newer, veered more into stuff, knowing that the slight shock value would get a response.
Yes.
You know, when you're new, you're so desperate for the laugh and for the response that you will take the easier route to it.
Yeah.
Just to, because you're more scared of the silence than the, you know, than thinking about, I might have said something that's actually a bit gross.
Yes.
Whereas nowadays, I think I still say stuff now and again that is pretty dark, but it's
mate,
always,
you were telling me earlier one of your punchlines, but it's also,
but it's about me,
it's about you, and and the context, it's got context,
loads of context to it.
You know, I can drop some stuff that has some edge to it, but the context of it is coming from it's not trying to shock you,
no.
It's explaining it before you get there.
And I think that's what I definitely just turned it all back on me and was like, if I'm gonna say something horrendous, it's gonna be about me, and it's gonna sound very honest, and like, this is more, you know, and there's no victim here apart from me.
Yeah. You know, for people listening to this podcast, if you go and see when you go and see Carl's show at the festivals, please write to me and tell me which joke you think we're talking about in his show, which is definitely dark and definitely directed at him, and I'll share it with Carl, or go up to him afterwards and say, "Hey, was it this joke?" And I have a feeling you might get it right.
Okay.
You know, getting back to show structure, the last show that I did, it was interesting. So, like, I took 7 months off performing after this is going right back after the last lockdown.
Yeah.
Because, well, I didn't go back to stand-up initially because I'd been lucky enough to work on 2 TV shows during lockdown. So I knew to go back and do a week at the store, there were comedians who needed that money.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll give a bit of time. Mm. And then after 7 months, I was like, this is great. I have not performed.
Yeah.
I can go out on a Friday, Saturday night. I can stay in on a Friday, Saturday night. And then COVID wiped out the store and they needed people at the last second. And I was like, it's a good idea to go and perform.
Yeah.
And keep your hand in. And then I did 3 nights and management called me and said, how'd it go? And I was like, oh, man. I went along, I said some jokes, I got a good response, there was lots of laughs, I had a really good time, and I've never been angrier. It's like it was like Al Pacino in The Godfather Part 3, just when I thought it was out, you know. And then I was like, well, let's book in a week of hosting, you know, because hosting's a good way to kind of find your footing again.
Yeah.
And then I hit the week that Will Smith slapped Chris Rock.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I was doing material about that, but every night I was checking my phone right up until I went on stage because I didn't want to walk on stage and go, hey, what about Will Smith? And someone yells out, he hung himself. You go, cool, here's your first act.
Oh, man.
So I was checking, but because it was so crazy, every time I was checking, there'd be some new information. Like, you know, I remember on the Thursday night, there's a clip of O.J. Simpson saying violence is never the answer. And you go, fuck, that's weird. I better talk about that. And then over the course of the week, I started off probably with a 3-minute bit and finished with a 10. And it was the building blocks of it that was the thing that really appealed to me about stand-up again. And then I just had a flurry of ideas. And then I was back in Adelaide and I asked Craig Egan, hey, can you put a few less people on? Because I really want to riff in the headline spot and see what I have.
Yeah.
And got to the end and thought, oh, that's about 40-ish minutes, that's possibly a show. And when I checked the recording, it was 70.
Bloody hell.
And I was like, Jesus. And then I was really panicky afterwards. I was saying to people in the audience, hey, how long did that feel? And they're like, 35, 40 minutes. I go, good. I didn't want it to be, that felt like 40 minutes. And you talk to people and they go, that felt like 3 hours. But then anyway, then I listened to it and there was a structure to the show and the structure was the order I'd put it in to remember it.
Right,
And then, so I wasn't looking for structure. I just went, here's five disparate things that I find funny. One was about a rapper who had been, a 24-year-old rapper called Gunu who had been shot dead. And his friends went and got his body out of the morgue and took him to the club and charged people to go and party with him one last time. The second story was about a woman who got done for murder, but the way she got caught was she self-published a book about how she'd murder her husband. And then a third one was about a guy in Singapore suing a woman for putting him in the friend zone and he'd lost. So there are all kind of stories like that. Yeah. And I just put it under the umbrella of so much weird shit happens in the world that normally things that we'd talk about for months on end, that one thing happens before you have time to think about it, the next thing happens. Yeah. And I put it under that umbrella and then that was the bit, you know? And it's funny, the more you do things, the structure ostensibly for stand-up is often just the audio that you can remember.
Yes. And it's like even with bits, I think the longer you've been doing it and the more you sort of know yourself.
Yeah.
The bits do form better, don't they? Like you're not starting every new routine or joke from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, if you see something funny or something funny happens to you or you think something funny, like normally the first time you write it down, it's at least got the format of a routine, isn't it? You're not, it's not just a bunch of words.
Yes.
Like even I often don't write, like if something happens to me that I want to do on stage as a story, I never write it down before I do it for the first time. I literally will go on stage and just tell the story and play around with it in the moment. And often the sort of natural punchline bits throughout the story just come out.
Yeah, they kind of present themselves,
don't they? And then you it's almost like reverse writing it. I'm writing it down off the back of what I'm saying on stage rather than the other way around.
I'm a little bit the same now as well. And then ostensibly I then will go back and I'll just write some notes of don't forget this bit, don't forget that bit. Do you ever have, this might sound insane, do you ever have moments where you kind of think about yourself in the third person and like as an act. So I have a, you know, it's only like about a 4 or 5 month old routine, but it's my favorite routine that I think I've up till this point written, which is a story about going to the cinema and being in the line, and two young girls come up and tell me it's the line up for Barbie, not Oppenheimer. Yeah. And anyway, I put this routine together, and then I remember doing it on stage and then coming home and just putting down point form the things to remember that I enjoyed hitting. And then I just looked at it and I literally looked and I went, oh yeah, that's what Hamo does. That's what that guy does.
Yeah.
Who's me? But that's what he talks about on stage. And I said, oh yeah, that feels right. And then I talked about this with Carl Barron actually.
Mm.
I said, Do you ever have moments like that? Carl's such a, have you ever met Carl?
No.
He's such a sweet man. He's such a lovely guy. I said that to Carl and he just kind of like thought about it, like really thought about it, and then looked at me and went, nah. But you know what it is. Carl only writes for himself. But because I think I write for, you know, I write for TV shows, I write for other comedians and all that kind of stuff, it's almost like I've now on the shelf. I'll take me down now and I'll write for me.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, do you ever get to the end of a routine and go, yeah, that's what I talk about?
No, I do sometimes sort of do a bit, like a story, and I'm like, I'm aware that it's very much in the vein of what I do. Like, you know, stylistically, I'm always like, yeah, that's a, I've seen this little move before, you know. But not in terms of a joke.
you know your tricks.
Well, yeah, like I'm quite fond of a little Shaggy Dog story on stage,
right?
Like, you know, one where you sort of, it's quite long-winded and funny along the way, but the end is just really, it's a non-event,
right?
And the joke is that you took the audience.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
On a little journey for 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
And then at the end is just nothing.
Yeah.
And so it's funny that I've done a joke with no punchline.
Right.
So like, it's something I've never seen, and I'm not saying like, I'm not saying this is like some amazingly original thing, but I've never seen another comic do it, really.
Right.
Do a sort of, I used to have one that was 7 or 8 minutes long, and I told them at the start of the routine, like at the start of the story, that like the end of this story is just shit. Like it's
going to dissipate,
underwhelming.
Yeah. Right?
And then I tell the story for long enough that they're laughing all the way.
Yeah.
And it's almost like they've forgotten at what I've told them.
Yes.
So when I finally do the totally underwhelming end.
Yeah.
It gets this pause of like, what? And then it gets a big laugh at, oh yeah, you told us you were going to do that.
Yeah, right.
And it's just a joke format that I've only ever, it's more of a, like an old pub joke format, you know, that sort of funny Shaggy Dog story.
Yeah.
Where you're doing it for a wind-up, essentially.
Yeah.
But I've never seen another comic do it. So I've done a few of those over the years where one will come to me and I'll be like, oh, here we go again.
Here we go. Thanks for returning.
Yeah.
I reckon I'm the opposite. I have a lot of routines over the years that something simple happens and I get more and more frustrated.
Yeah.
And then it builds to a crescendo.
Right, having,
you know, ostensibly a pop moment.
Yes.
But it's a lot of minutiae.
You're right.
You know, the last show I did, I had a story, which is a completely true story, about buying something on Amazon and having it sent to me and being told it had been delivered, and and I getting in touch with someone, and it's, you know, it's a new person every time. Yeah, so you're having to go through exactly, because I've been trained. So it's the same conversation.
Yes.
And but I honestly went to three different post offices, to a 7-Eleven, and to a news agent in a supermarket complex that was getting knocked down, and that the news agency was the only place, and just not being able to find this thing, and then getting the money back, and then 2 days later it arrived. and at the time I was like I was so angry and so frustrated about this whole thing. Then it arrived, and then I was like, oh, this has worked out well. And then it was like, you know, later that day I'm eating lunch and I went, this is going on stage.
Yeah. It's you always feel a bit bad when you do that, when you've really, you know, lent into this is unacceptable sort of customer services.
Yep.
And then ultimately it was just your lack of patience.
Just my lack of patience. Well, they, in my defense, they told me that it arrived. So if they hadn't told me that, I would have just been gladly waiting. Do you ever bring back old routines?
Well, I didn't used to.
Yeah.
But I have recently done it for two routines that... And weirdly, one of them has become quite a big routine in this new show.
Yeah.
And it's because it came out... I just did it in a club. I hadn't done it for about 3 years. It's about a 3 or 4 year old.
Yeah.
No, it's probably 3 years because it's a story and it's about something that happened when I was, I think, 39. So but it used to be a 2 minute bit. That was a 2 minute little story as part of a bigger routine.
Right.
And recently, I think something came up on stage and I went, oh, this thing happened to me. Because I hadn't done a routine in like 2 years.
Yeah.
I just told the story of what actually happened, which I didn't originally, but because it was only a little part of a bigger bit.
Yeah.
It was a little throwaway. Oh, this is something that happened as well.
Yeah.
But because I was just telling just that bit.
Yeah.
I just sort of lent into it. And suddenly I did like 5 minutes telling the story. And in my head, I was like, after the gig, and it went really well. After the gig, I was like, that story went really well. And it was funny. And I was telling loads of details that I'd probably not put in the routine originally.
Yeah.
Because I was just telling it from memory.
Yeah.
And I sort of went and just sat down and made a few notes. And next gig I did, I went and did it again. And it was like 7 minutes long.
Yes.
And then I started adding some little bits off it. And then now, like, it's about, you know, it's probably in its full form currently about a 15-minute long story.
Yeah, right.
And it's got loads of little tangents off
it. Yeah.
And it's great. Like, and that's from an old bit that, just was a little throwaway aside.
That's great.
So I would do it in that. I'm not really one for bringing back just a routine as it was.
Yeah.
I'm quite good at just letting them go.
Yeah.
Even if I loved them. Like, you know, I had in a show a couple of years ago, I had a routine about shower gels, which was, I think, the best observational routine I've ever written.
Yeah.
You know, it was based in and around a story, but the story was me trying a shower gel that I really liked.
Yeah.
Which is not a good start to any stand-up story, really. But it ended up getting so big. And it was like, I think I once managed to make it 20 minutes long.
Right.
I did a whole like club set in the UK. Just starting point was, has anyone tried this shower gel? And I named it, and it got a cheer because it's quite a, you know, it's got a tea tree and mint original sauce.
Yeah.
The one that's sort of like, the tea tree just makes your bits tingle.
Right.
So I said to the audience, like, has anyone tried this? And like, got a cheer. And I just then went into this 20-minute observational routine basically about original source shower gels.
Yeah.
And that I think was genuinely the best, like the amount of detail I went into about shower gels, about, you know, and it was just, it's so such a non-event of a topic.
Yeah.
That I loved the fact that it was my entire set.
Yeah.
And it was on most nights when I did it, it was an absolute killer of a routine.
Yeah.
And but I just sort of let it go. And I remember like being like, I think I'm done with that now. And now, okay, I think I'd struggle now to do it.
Yeah.
Longer. You know, if I did it now, I'd probably miss out loads of stuff. I'd forget it.
Well, if you
it'd
don't
be a 10-minute bit or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's nice. I no matter how good a routine is, I often just go like, well, that we've had our time.
Yep.
It's like a relationship that
yep.
didn't work out. But it did, like, it was great, but wasn't going to be forever.
Yeah. No, we had a great time in Paris, but this relationship's not going to work in London. I had to do Valentine's Day, not this year, last year, two shows on Valentine's Day. I was talking to Adam Richard, and I was like, fucking hell, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I've been single for so long, but, you know, there'll be couples there and blah, blah, blah. And he mentioned an old routine of mine that I had not done in, like, 6 years or something like that. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know what, maybe, oh, yeah, that's not a bad idea. And then trying to remember it, trying to remember the beats.
Yeah.
And I couldn't remember the context, so I created a whole new context for it. And then did it on Valentine's Day, and then it was like, went really well.
Yeah.
And I was
like,
oh, I'm here for, at the store for the rest of the week. I might as well keep it. And did it for the rest of the week. And then it's really funny. Once upon a time, I would have felt bad about this, but I had all the people at the store and all these young comics go, wow, your new routine's a killer.
Yeah,
and you
go,
thanks. I think I've just, when I was younger, I think I was so, right, that's done, move on. And now I'm just like, if I'm enjoying it again.
Yeah.
Like, there was obviously a reason I stopped doing it, because like you said, you move on.
Yeah.
But now if I found a new context to it, I'm happy to bring it back.
Yeah.
And enjoy it.
And it's, I will say, it's quite fun sometimes if, like, it just happens on a night to come up.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only time I would do an old routine. And I wouldn't do it, again, it wouldn't be exactly like I used to do it. If I haven't done it for ages, I genuinely have forgotten most of it.
Yeah.
But, like, last weekend, I think it was Saturday night, I was doing a gig in Melbourne. And there was a Bucks party on the front.
Mm.
But they were lovely. They were really chill. They weren't, it wasn't like a loud, leery one. And I just went on, and about a minute in, I just addressed them and I chatted to them. And they were so twee that I sort of laughed and was like, I'm so impressed with you guys. Like, you know, because in the UK, it was like 9:30 PM. And I was like, you know, there's not a single stag do in the UK that is in this state at 9:30 PM.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me of a story I used to do on stage, and this was probably about 4 or 5 years ago as well, about going on a stag do to Estonia. I went on there was a 16 man stag do to Estonia.
Wow.
And it was just gross,
right?
But and it just reminded me of it, and I said to him,
sorry, I wasn't expecting that. It was gross.
But it just came into my mind when I was chatting to them. And I said actually reminds me of I went on one of these, but it was a British and Irish one.
Yeah.
I said, going to Estonia, and I just started the story, and I went into the story having just not told it on stage for 4 years, whatever.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun remembering it and telling it again. Just I was laughing telling it.
Yes.
It's a really funny and mad story. It's about me drunkenly trying to buy drugs in Tallinn in Estonia.
Right.
And ending up in an alleyway with a guy with a machete. It's all true.
Jesus.
I genuinely thought I was going to get murdered.
Yeah.
But it goes to such an extreme, like, place almost, like, literally for me starting just drunk in a bar in Tallinn, and it ends up with me with a machete in my face,
right?
And I was telling the story, and I got into this sort of rolling laugh myself, retelling it, and the audience really got into the moment. So I think that's the audience really like when they can see the person's enjoying themselves and they're enjoying the story, but they know that you're genuinely just sort of,
you're not in
a little hysteria.
Yeah, you're not finding yourself funny. You're enjoying the
telling. Yeah, it's just, and it was, and just, I just, that was the rest of my set, was just this story.
Great.
And it was such fun remembering it.
Yeah. Jeez, Bucks parties can, like, a bad Bucks party can ruin friendships, I reckon.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was literally talking to a friend of mine a couple of days ago, and I can't even remember how it came up, but we just remembered a mate of ours at a Bucks party, and it was, his behavior was so weird. Like, he wasn't rude or anything, but it was just so weird how into it he was,
right,
that we all kind of were like, you're a dad in your 40s.
I used to do a routine about going on these. It was like, it actually was a separate routine.
Yeah.
I've got another story about going on one to Spain.
Right.
So I used to have a routine about how, like,
And when I do it, when I've so done it funny. Here,
like I've been on Bucks parties that have gone to Coburg.
Yeah.
You've gone to Spain.
Well, this is it. Like when I did the routine here a few years ago, it was about the fact that Bucks parties here are so nice and local.
Yeah.
And like, and I talked about how in the UK, like we literally invade
another country,
you know, sort of Eastern European countries,
right?
And in the routine about what's going to one in Spain, I talk about how like the worst person on a stag do is always a married father of three in their 40s.
Yes,
and I said because they're the ones who need it.
Yes,
that's a dangerous person to have on a stag. Yes, they need a release of tension.
Oh, the way they drink.
Oh yeah,
the way
they drink, forgetting they haven't got the capacity for it because yes. they've literally spent the last 8 years
yes
raising a family
yes
and they're working hard and they're literally just exhausted, 8 years of exhaustion.
Yeah.
And they suddenly are on a stag do and they start drinking at 6 a.m. in an airport. Oh. And, you know, by 3 p.m., they are, like, paraplegic.
Yes.
And it's mad.
Yeah. And you're looking at them going, like, this person in particular, my mate and I were like, are you all right? Like, are you having a nervous breakdown?
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he was trying to grab other guys and kiss them, thinking it was hilarious. And we were like, oh, like, to be honest, this behavior would have been weird in our 20s. But now it's just, I haven't caught up with him in ages. And last time I saw him, like, it was just, hey, how are you?
I've got one of my oldest friend on earth. We've been friends since we were 3 years old. Cute. And, you know, we couldn't have had more different lives, really. Like, we've just always been friends just because we were just friends from that. Yeah, we went to nursery together.
Right.
And, you know, he hated school. I didn't like school, but I still did the bare minimum to get through it.
Yeah.
The moment we got to 16, he was out. He just went and got, like, a job on building site. And,
right.
You know, and then he's gone through periods where, you know, he's done all right out of that work, and periods where he's been out of work, and he had kids really early. Like, we just had such different lives, but we've always been friends, and like we don't see each other that often, but, you know, every few months we'll have a nice, I'll go around, we'll see the family and all that stuff. Mm. But he was always a real nightmare drinker. Like, on a night out, he was just so, he had a point of drunkenness, about 4 or 5 pints.
Right.
And this was back in the day when he could drink, you know, 12 pints over the night, but by the moment he hit about 5, his eyes sort of went, and his eyes went so mischievous, like he had this little glint in his eye, that you just, the moment you saw that, you're like, we're in trouble. Like,
yes,
we're gonna get kicked out of this pub because he's gonna do something weird.
Yes.
And it could be like sort of getting into an altercation with another guy.
Right.
It could be he'll start breakdancing in front of a group of girls. It was just, there was no rhyme nor reason to it.
Yeah.
Like, and, or it could be like, oh, he's just going to get his knob out for no reason. Like, it was just chaos the moment he got drunk. And then,
it's like he spins the wheel.
Yeah.
I'm going to pretend to be a duck.
Oh my God. And like then he had a family quite young, and he sort of wound it in and stopped drinking that. And he now is a very, very settled family man, but then he's had quite a lot of issues. Like, two of his daughters had quite a weird genetic thing that meant they had to undergo a lot of like really intense surgical stuff. And like at points, it looked like they, like both of them actually, and there's a big gap between them, looked like they might not, you know, make it.
Right.
And luckily, they're all fine, but like everyone got through it. And like it really hit him. His mental health was really bad, and he definitely was really protective of not drinking because he knew like it just he wasn't in the mind to drink.
Yeah.
And then about 4 years ago, we had a barbecue, and he came, and he, like, the barbecue started at like 2 p.m. And he got there at 1. And just like, and I went, I had a big bucket of beers, and I'd already started one because I was preparing food.
Yeah.
And I went, are you having, what are you doing? I said, are you drinking at the minute or not? And he goes, I'll have a beer. And he's had one. And then, you know, flash forward to 2 p.m. when people start arriving. Me and him have already had 3 beers.
Right.
And, like, he just, over the next couple of hours, got so problematic.
Right.
Like, it's the only time I've ever had to literally kick a mate out of my own house. Like, literally say to him, you have to go home. You can't be here. You're causing problems.
Right.
Like, literally, you're making everyone you're putting everyone on edge.
Yeah.
And I had to just call an Uber and I had to put him in it.
Yeah.
Like, and just go, mate, get home. And I messaged his wife and I said, I'm sending him home because he's pissed and he's really, like, gone a bit mad.
Yeah.
And, like, she said he fell out of the taxi at the other end and, like...
Right.
But it was just that thing. He's like, he just had that middle-aged, stressed dad thing. Of the moment a beer went to his lips, he could feel the tension, like, releasing and, like, just went bananas.
Yeah.
Like, he was saying, oh my God. Like, I still cringe thinking about it. Like... Like, I don't,
sorry,
like,
I'm not laughing because it's funny, but I just being around that kind of thing.
Because it,
it
wasn't just like the problem was if it was just my old mates, who've known him since we were kids, there wouldn't be a problem. Everyone would be like, "That's Daniel's off on his mad
here
one
we go.
Again."
Yeah,
but because it was loads of like Hannah's friends and you know some of them, like some people like, oh yeah, I remember like Hannah's friend who's an acting friend, who's a really successful actor. She's lovely, just. Like Daniel just got really weird around her, not in a sort of sexual way,
right?
But just kept sort of floating around her a bit, and like had because his eyes go crazy.
Yeah,
he wasn't doing anything intimidating other than just being there.
Just not.
And he's quite a big, imposing guy as well. Yeah. So I think everyone was just like, "Fucking, who is this? Madman."
Yeah,
and it was brutal having to kick him out. You know, sort of literally remove a friend from your house is horrible.
Yeah.
But it had to be done.
It had to be done. The I've had a couple of friends who have wanted to, you know, really get back on it and have all-nighters. I can't think of anything worse. Like, we had a pretty late night last night.
Yeah.
But, that was heaps for me.
Yes.
And that'll do me for... a while now.
Yeah.
But I got some friends who have been, you know, 5-6 in the morning kind of thing.
Oh, that makes me feel sick now.
Mate, I got trapped with a mate who was, you know, I didn't realise was on it.
Yeah.
And it got to 4 a.m. and I just could not break out of this conversation.
Oh, no.
And they were, you know, really expressing a lot of things that were going on in their life. And it's also, like, I'm friends with the partner as well. And I'm like, this is... Hey, I'm glad that you're talking, but also this is a lot.
Yeah.
And the irony was that earlier in the day, this person had been saying to me, "You take on too much of your friend's shit," and then it's 4 a.m. and I'm like, I have to go to bed.
Yeah.
Like every time I try to get out of the conversation, something else came up, and then it's like, okay, well, let's just ride this out. And then I just had to go to bed, and then the next day they were like really apologetic because they knew what they'd done. But it was like, it made me, like, the idea of pulling an all-nighter makes me dry rich, because also it's going to take days for me to put myself back together.
Yes. Like, even like last night, I like a drink. I probably drink... You know, I might drink a couple of nights a week, but always at gigs. It's a social thing. I'm not, you know, I never drink at home. Like, I just wouldn't even cross my mind if I'm sat at home on an evening watching something to be like, I'll crack a beer. Like, no slight on people that do. I'm just saying, for me, I've always, again, it's probably growing up in and around pubs.
Yeah.
For me, drinking is a social thing.
Yes.
Like, Hannah actually always, she gets a bit annoyed with me because, like, she likes to sort of, you know, especially now because we're staying with her parents while we're in Melbourne. Like, her and her mum love a little crack open a little bubbly thing with dinner. And, like, sort of, Hannah sometimes gets a bit annoyed that I don't ever want to partake in drinking at home.
Right.
You know, not annoyed, but she finds it weird that I've got such an aversion to it.
Yeah.
And I think it's, I would say it's probably a mixture of loving pubs.
Yeah.
And also... just, I don't know, because I think because I've come from a family with a very long history of alcohol problems.
Mm.
Like, almost everyone in my family at some point has had them.
Yeah.
I'm always like, it's like I've put in some very specific ground rules with myself to never even venture down there.
Yes.
You know, and it's worked my whole life. I've gone through phases where, like, you know, I could go to the Edinburgh Fringe and basically get drunk every night for a month.
Right.
You know, and then I'll come back from the Fringe and I won't drink for 2 weeks. Well, it wouldn't even cross my mind to have another one. I've never ever managed to fall into a period where, like, even on paper, if you said, like, if you're drinking every day, but it's like, because I'm at a festival.
Yeah.
And it's a social thing.
Yeah.
But the moment I'm just back to normal life and at home, I wouldn't dream of having a...
Worst drinking I've ever, like, sustained drinking is during... Back when I used to do the festivals.
Yeah, yeah.
And the moment when I realised that I was drinking a lot at festivals would be that when someone said, did you have a big one last night? You go, it was a pretty subdued night. And then you'd think about it, you'd think, I had 4 spirits, I had 2 wines, and I got to bed at 2:30.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go, that's a lot.
That's, yeah, for a normal night, that would be fine.
If that's a subdued night, what have you been doing on...
That would be a big... Yeah, that's a night out.
Yeah.
But for you, it's a quiet night at a festival.
Yeah, big night to me is the night when Limo and I were just on a bender buying everybody tequila at the Hi-Fi bar. The last thing I remember is having my arms around my manager at the time and yelling at the ceiling, because that was Tom Gleason and I, it makes us laugh to yell at the ceilings, yell at the air.
I was
yelling at the ceiling, this is why I do commercial radio. And then I wake up and my partner at the time was like, wow, you were fucked last night. And then Limo went to the Hi-Fi bar the next night and the barman said, hey, come over here. And he said, yeah. And he said, do you want to know how much you and Hamo spent on tequila last night? And Limo was like, not really, but why? And he said, it got to a point where you were buying everyone so much tequila and we were also giving it to you at... started discounting it, but you guys spent $700 on tequila.
God.
And, like, someone had just walked up and was like, do you want a tequila? And, like...
Oh, God.
And...
Yeah.
Like, you know, had a good time and glad I did it.
Yeah.
Oh, I could not do it now. No. And it just even got a little shake.
Yeah.
A little shiver just thinking about it.
But that's what I mean when they're saying, like, I probably... A lot of my mates hardly drink at all now. Yeah, I've got mates who've just stopped drinking totally. Like, oh, this doesn't agree with me anymore. But I still do drink. I still like a drink.
Yeah.
But the thought of it being a 4 or 5 a.m. Last night was later than I would normally dream of going, unless it was some extreme case.
Yeah.
But nowadays, like, I really like just a few beers, nice chat with some people, and being home and in bed by midnight. That's my happy place.
Yeah. Well, I honestly think the reason it went later for us last night was because we were watching the CrossFit Games on TV. The weirdest ESPN show event we've ever seen, with these really muscular women lifting sacks and putting them through hoops.
There is fun. I mean, because this area, I feel like anytime I end up drinking late in this area, it's something weird about it. It's something like... It's always something quite... almost David Lynch-y going on. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, last time I was in town was November, and I had actually a really late night then. I remember I so wanted to go back to the hotel, and I think it might have been, though, the last night we were in Sydney, and so the people I was touring with, like, and everyone wanted to go out. So we had dinner, and then there was, like, talk of going back to the hotel, and somebody was like, no, come on, let's get another drink. And we went to another bar, and then that one shut about half an hour later. And in my head, I was like, thank the Lord, we're now definitely going home.
Yes.
And then somebody went, oh, no, let's get a taxi to Surrey Hills and go to the Strawberry Hotel.
Yeah.
And we walked in there, and it was probably, I don't know, 12:30, 1 in the morning.
Yeah.
And it was honestly like we'd walked into some sort of surreal nightmare.
Yeah.
There was just one group of crazy people over here.
Yeah.
There was a guy on his own on the pool table.
Yeah.
Playing pool, wearing big noise-canceling headphones and dancing in between shots. Like,
right.
Just really, like, really weird dancing. Not like...
Yeah.
Not like a... Not like he's in a club.
Yeah.
It was like he was sort of in some weird... like performance art show, like, and just everything just fell off.
Yeah.
Like, there was no music on, it was just all quiet. Just like, oh, God.
Yeah. Surrey Hills is a bit weird. Like, I remember being out with, who was I with? I think I was with my mate Malk, Richard Feidler, and Mark Humphreys. And we were having a drink, and someone just walked up and put in front of us an upside down mushroom cracked, but that was split open, and they'd put a raw egg in the middle of it, and it was and just put it down, and then just kind of looked at us and walked off, and we honestly just continued talking,
yeah,
and then it was ages before
we kind of looked at it and went, oh, that poor guy really thought he was freaking us out.
But
he doesn't realize the worlds we've lived in. And yes, this is...
It's not my first mushroom filled.
Filled. I can't even be bothered making a "I bet he was a fun guy" kind of joke. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's like I'm happy to just kind of keep moving. But there is something like this area feels like. To me, it feels like a suburb of Melbourne with much more vitamin D, and also it's very artsy. But then it's also, you know, like one morning on a Sunday morning, these are the kinds of things I see all the time. I was standing on that balcony having a little coffee and I watched a pretty drunk guy wandering this, crossing the road, and he was staggering and he walked into a car, parked car, and set off the alarm. And the alarm was going, and this guy looked at the alarm and went back to it. And he just kept making that noise. And then the car stopped and he stopped and he walked off. And I just kind of was like, yep, that feels like what happens on this street.
Yeah,
Surrey Hills. Hey, we should finish up, but you're about to do the festivals. Did you do Perth?
I didn't know. So I didn't do Perth or Adelaide. I'm not doing Adelaide. I'm just going straight into Melbourne. I've done a few work in progresses.
Yep.
I've got a few more, and then I'm just going to dive straight into Melbourne, and then I'm in Sydney for the first weekend of the Comedy Festival as well.
Oh, great. Oh, that's... So you kind of roll it all up and then you're done.
Do it then. And then I think got a few bits afterwards, then back to the UK.
Yeah.
I'm currently in the process of deciding whether or not to do the Edinburgh Fringe.
Okay.
I've got some options. I've got a nice venue offer. But I'm just in my mind. I've not done the full Fringe since 2019.
Right.
Like last year, when I did 5 nights, and it was great, just doing a short run.
Yes.
So there's something about, like, I don't mind doing a full run in Melbourne.
Right.
You know, and I like Sydney for the fact that no one does a long run in Sydney Comedy Festival. People just come and do a few nights.
And then that's it.
And like Adelaide nowadays, a lot of people are just doing shorter runs. Like the whole landscape shifted.
Yeah.
But Melbourne, I find, because Melbourne's quite a small festival, really. I know it's got much bigger.
Yeah.
But it's just comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a fringe, so it doesn't feel as all-encompassing.
Yeah.
And it's all the shows are in the evening. You know, it's sort of from 6 o'clock, they'll be the first ones, and goes through till 11, 12, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it feels much more... It doesn't take over your life.
Yeah.
You can still live a normal life while doing Melbourne Comedy Festival, I think.
Yeah.
But Edinburgh isn't like that. Edinburgh is... You're in it. Like it's a month of...
Yeah.
You know, it's heavy. You're in, like... It's so... You can't walk anywhere without... being surrounded by 1,000 people doing shows.
I feel like Adelaide's a bit like that. It's
a fringe small. And it's very, there's hubs.
Yeah.
And it's just everywhere is, you know, you walk everywhere, there's street performance and like, and it just, you know, there's no getting away from the fact you're at a festival doing a show.
Yeah.
You know, very rarely feel like you're just having a normal day.
Yeah, and but Edinburgh, you can have that in Melbourne.
Yeah, Melbourne you definitely can, because like in the daytime you wouldn't even see anything to do with it, basically. Yeah. But yes, and Edinburgh, I think, is the most extreme. So it's like, you know, it's a bigger fringe than Adelaide, isn't it?
Yes. No,
it's the biggest fringe in the world, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I think Adelaide's second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a bigger festival, and it's in a much smaller, you know, it's condensed into, I wouldn't even say a square mile. It's smaller than a square mile. It's such a tiny, like, Edinburgh's a small city at the best of times, but the actual bit where the venues are is into, like, you know, it's probably a square 600 meters or something, and there's hundreds of thousands of people crammed into it.
Whereas even though Adelaide's a small city that is that knows the whole fringes on, Adelaide's a really nicely made city.
Yes.
Like everything's actually quite spaced out, you know, so it doesn't feel quite as
it's not a gothic, like sort of Scottish city, grey and beautiful city.
Yeah,
but you know, it's very much, you spend a lot of time walking down cobbled back streets.
Yeah,
it's sort of quite a sort of it is a heavy city to walk around, to spend a month as well.
Yeah,
there's too many people crammed into a small city. Even though, and it's, you know, you don't really get to appreciate Edinburgh when you go there during the fringe, because it's not real Edinburgh. It's like you can't have an extra million people over
a month come into a city that size and
yeah.
still get a sense of it. You can't walk down the street without there being like, you know, it takes you 10 minutes to walk down the street that would take 1 minute normally because there's so many people on it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go to outside a festival, it's one of the most beautiful cities on the planet.
Right.
Like, it's gorgeous and nice and relaxed. Yeah. And, oh, it's lovely.
The I couldn't do a full festival again. Like, it's funny, that last show I did, I think I honestly did 8 performances.
I
felt pretty happy with that. I felt pretty content. I only did one in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I was wrapped. I had a great time. It was a fantastic night. And why ruin it by doing a second?
Yeah.
I got everything I needed I wanted from it out of that performance.
Yes.
So, you know, I understand the trepidation of...
Yeah.
But like, it might be fun.
If, but if I'm going to really... Like, if I do... I'm going to basically decide in the next probably 2-3 weeks... Mm. And if I do the full run in Edinburgh, like I definitely will really, like, it would be really good doing the full run in Melbourne just to, like, you know, to constantly still be working on the show.
Mm.
You know, I'm not going to think of it as a finished thing.
Yeah.
I want to, you know, by the end of Melbourne, I'll have the show that I was happy with in Melbourne.
Yeah.
But then I'll have a few months to be like, now what do I do with it?
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I think I will change it up quite substantially for Edinburgh.
For Edinburgh. Where are you in Melbourne?
I'm at the Victoria Hotel,
which is
nice. I've done it before, and it's a really cool venue.
Yeah,
the more I've done comedy, the more nowadays when I do a venue, I think more about what's it like for the audience before the show.
Yeah,
you know how I like them to come in good moods.
Yeah,
and I've done some venues where there's not much of a place for them to relax beforehand, and they just got a queue outside.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if it's raining, they're just queuing up in the rain, basically.
Yeah.
And what I like about the Vic, and I had it last year, I did the Western Hotel last year, which is now really cool. You know, I've been using it for a few years, the comedy festival, as a venue, and they've managed to make it into a little hub, and there's four different performance spaces upstairs, and there's a nice little bar, and
Great. It's
just a cool place for people to hang out before the show, and then they get called up to the venue.
Yeah.
And the Vic Hotel, I think, has got a really lovely atmosphere before and after shows. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And what time?
7:50.
Oh, that's
just a nice time.
Yeah, that's sweet.
Yeah. Because, Melbourne is one of them cities where you don't want to be... I did 9:45 one year and it was... Yeah. I was like, this is too late for Melbourne. These people want to go to bed early.
I did the Vic Hotel 2 years in a row at 9:45.
Yeah.
First year, great. Really great weather. Right. It was warm at night and it was awesome. The next year, it was getting dark at 5 p.m. and there was someone on at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
who consistently ran over. So my show was, you know, the person who runs over by 5 minutes at the start of the night means that your show goes up 20, 25 minutes late every night. And I felt it for the audience because I was thinking I don't want to be here.
Yeah, it's a bit late.
Too late.
Whereas, I mean, it's different. I would say somewhere like Adelaide or like a fringe, I think you can get away with being later.
Mm.
Like, I'm thinking of actually doing my show later in Edinburgh this year than I ever have done. I think I might do the latest show I've ever done.
Right.
But for fun reasons. Like, I think I would change the show to be more of a night's cap. And so I've got ideas about doing that.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't dream of doing a show much later in Melbourne, I think.
Yeah.
During the week, people in Melbourne are just like, you know, they're not night owls, are they?
No, we've got stuff to do, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 7:50 at the Vic Hotel in Melbourne and Sydney. Do you know
Sydney? I'm doing the Enmore Theatre Wine Bar.
Oh, great.
On the first Thursday. And the festival starts on the Thursday, the 20th. Something the last
April?
End of April.
Yeah.
So I'm doing the first Thursday and Friday.
Oh yeah, great. Great. That's excellent. And where can people find you?
Just online. Instagram is now the one that
I
tend to still go begrudgingly to. Use.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know what I mean?
I've got the algorithm, so they're showing me NBA stuff, they're showing me stuff about animals being cute and random comic book covers and panels, and it's great.
I hardly look at it anymore, but that is the one I use. I still post stuff on there.
Yeah.
But like, I Twitter, I hardly ever go on. I downloaded TikTok and for a couple of weeks and then got rid of it because I was like, this one is literally going to destroy my brain.
Mate, I downloaded TikTok, 2018, I reckon, 2017. And I reckon I had a few minutes where I just went, nah.
Yeah.
This good on anyone who can use it, but this is going to be unhealthy for me, and I can tell right now.
Well, I've got an app. I recently downloaded an app to on the iPhone called Opal, and it's basically a screen time app where you can just block your phone.
Oh, yes.
Apart from certain things.
Yeah.
So now most of the day my phone is only, I can only use it for like WhatsApp. So if I get messages or phone calls.
Yeah.
And I can't look at social media.
Yeah.
I can use the internet. Like, I can go on if I need to Google something.
Yeah.
I can look at IMDb if I'm watching something and want to know who's that.
Yeah.
You know, I can just use things that you would only naturally use for 1 or 2 minutes.
Yes.
Nothing that you can actually scroll on. Nothing that can just keep your attention.
Yeah.
And I've had it on for a few weeks and it's an absolute game changer. Like,
yeah.
My screen time, I'm not one of these people that sits on it for 9 hours a day.
Right.
But on days when I've had down, like, especially when I'm away from like home gigging.
Yeah.
You know, you can find yourself just sitting around, just scrolling, reading about stuff and looking on Instagram and going off on little tangents. And like, you know, before you know it, you've looked at social media for 3 hours in that day.
Yes.
So now, like, my phone usage, the screen time's right down. But what's really down is social media. I mean, I'm probably in the last couple of weeks, my social media over the day is 10 minutes a day.
Yeah.
If 15 at a push. And the rest of the usage is watching something on a flight on Netflix. Like, and it's great. And I feel like I'm sleeping better.
Yeah.
It just helps your brain work better. Like, you're not wasting so much mental energy.
Yeah. You can sit with it. You know, it's not overstimulated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I recommend it.
All right. I'm going to do that. I'm going to let you go. I'm going to finish up this podcast as well because I have not forgotten the story about the person who has the photo on their phone and I'm dying to know who it is and I'm going to ask you as soon as I press stop now. Thank you to Carl Donnelly for joining me today. What a treat, right? What a naturally lovely man. And to be honest, that podcast could have easily gone for another hour. We was having such a nice time having a chat with him. Please go and check out his show at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and Sydney Comedy Festival. Heads up for Patreon subscribers. In case you haven't noticed, there's some old Can You Take This Photo Please podcasts. I put up a recent one with Richard Feidler. And those old chats with Rove. Have we put up Rove yet? No, maybe not Rove. But there's definitely Richard and Will and a few others from 10, 12 years ago. They're kind of fascinating to listen to now, knowing where they're at and how things have changed or how things haven't changed. So, yes, you can pick those up at Patreon. You can pick up other bonus podcasts and you can also, I can send you some free tickets to things as well through that site too. We managed to get some for Rob Carlton for my subscribers in Adelaide. And anytime I can throw some treats out that way, the Patreon site is where they will land. Also, it's all ad-free as well, which makes things a lot more fun. One more quick shout-out to everyone who is still listening to The Ultimate, which was the long-form story under the Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted banner. There's a few of you who are having a really good time. There's a lot of you around the 18 to 22 chapter mark. So I won't say any more, but it's just a real pleasure to have people writing to me and letting me know how much they're enjoying that. That was a real labor of love. So I'm glad that it has found an audience with you. Okay, I am going off to see some space worms. Yes, that's what Dune is all about in my head. Big, massive space worms. Sounds kind of rude. Anyway, you've been great. Thank you so much for listening. It's always appreciated, and we will speak soon. Until then.
Mom deserves
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.